Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGMU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear from the NAACP Aurora chapter about the Elijah McLean case. What happened on Saturday when police used tear gas and pepper spray on peaceful protesters who had gathered, and why it's taken almost a year to have the case get the kind of attention it's now getting. Then, a citizen initiative slated for November would provide renters facing eviction with legal aid. That won't take effect in time, though, to help those losing their housing due to COVID-19 unemployment. But backers of the measure say that it's long overdue. We'll have more coming up. After that, we'll hear about what it's like to be an undocumented immigrant in this country. June is Immigrant Heritage Month, and as we round out the month, we'll hear from Modus Theatre. And in fact, at 8:35, we'll hear more from Modus Theatre as we present Shoebox Stories. It's a podcast that they have been producing, having national figures read the stories that have been written by undocumented immigrants. We'll hear from one undocumented immigrant on the Morning Magazine. Then at 8:35, on a public affair, we'll hear one of the episodes of Shoebox Stories. In fact, we're going to be launching a series that'll be coming your way in July. At 9 o'clock, it is media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Aurora police are facing questions about their use of pepper spray and claims they used non-lethal weapons on protesters Saturday. Nine News reports that hours after the demonstrators began, police said the protest turned unlawful. Earlier on Saturday afternoon, thousands of protesters gathered at the Aurora Municipal Center demonstrating against the death of Elijah McLean, who succumbed after being detained by police in 2019. The peaceful assembly began at about 1 p.m., and at one point, protesters marched onto Interstate 25 and temporarily shut down the highway in both directions. A second rally, organized by Students for Elijah McLean, took place around 4 p.m. at the Municipal Center. Denver 7 reports that police said the demonstrations remained peaceful and there were no arrests or injuries reported. However, around 8 p.m., police then said protesters removed a barrier near police headquarters and tore down some plywood that was protecting windows on the municipal building. At about 8:20 p.m., Aurora police declared an unlawful assembly and said a small contingent of protesters were arming themselves with rocks and sticks and continued to ignore orders to move back. Officers then used pepper spray on demonstrators. One man who was sprayed said that he had first been shoved in the stomach with a baton. That scene contrasted sharply with violinists who were performing at the same time, honoring McLean, who played the instrument. The Denver Post reports that eight violinists in a circle played beautiful, soft melodies. People slowly walked over, leaving the riot gear-clad police, and sat on the pavement, lighting candles and listening quietly to McLean's favorite instrument. The use of force by police on Saturday night was one of the first after Senate Bill 217 was signed into law, making them more accountable for their actions. State Senator Leslie Herod, a Democrat, told Denver 7 that if you're not upset by what happened in Aurora on Saturday, you're not paying attention. She added that she is calling on Aurora Mayor Michael Kaufman to specifically address the use of chemical weapons on protesters on Saturday and to take swift action to rectify the situation. We'll hear more about what happened on Saturday and the Elijah McLean case after headlines. The city of Denver has reached an agreement with four people who sued over the police department's use of force during the George Floyd protests, officials said. The Associated Press reports that the plaintiffs filed their lawsuit against the city and the police department June 5th after claiming they were injured by law enforcement officers while protesting police brutality. The lawsuit claims officers misused tear gas, flashbang grenades, and non-lethal bullets during protests in Denver. A judge must approve the agreement. The details of the settlement are currently unknown, and the date when it could become final. The American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado filed a second lawsuit over the use of force on Thursday on behalf of Black Lives Matter 5280 in Denver. That lawsuit was not part of the settlement. Multiple groups in Denver are coming together to host a virtual town hall this week with a goal to create a task force to reimagine policing in Denver. CBS 4 reports that the Greater Metro Denver Ministerial Alliance is joined by the Interfaith Alliance of Colorado and the Denver Citizen Oversight Board. Dr. Robert Davis of the Denver Ministerial Alliance said that they need to ask themselves, what does it look like to bring community and policing and all of the various social services together to come up with a model that is unique for Denver? The virtual town hall will be Tuesday at 6 p.m. In Denver on Friday, city crews removed a statue of Kit Carson that had topped a monument in downtown Denver at the intersection of Colfax and Broadway. The Colorado Sun reports it's the third art installation memorializing a controversial figure to be removed from public spaces in Denver in 2 days. A city spokesperson said the removal was done proactively for safety and as a precautionary measure to keep it from being torn down, similar to the sculpture at Civic Center Park Thursday. Protesters tore down a Civil War statue at the Capitol early on Thursday morning, and a sculpture in Civic Center dedicated to Christopher Columbus on Thursday night. Glenn Morris, a leadership council member of the American Indian Movement, said that Kit Carson was as bad as and as evil as any Confederate general to black people. He added that racism against black Americans and oppression of Native Americans were intertwined as the two original sins, the U.S. genocide of indigenous peoples and the enslavement of Africans. The Denver Public Schools will return to in-person classes this fall. Superintendent Susanna Cordova said that at a Friday news conference that the district's 92,000 students will move back to in-person instruction for the school year at all of the district schools. School days will look a lot different for students with mandatory masks, health screenings upon entering schools, and modified schedules that keep cohorts of kids together. However, the Colorado Sun reports the district will also offer online schooling option for grades K through 12 to accommodate families uncomfortable sending their kids back to classrooms. Meanwhile, a Denver elementary school principal has been removed from her position after an investigation found she discriminated against an 8-year-old black student because of his race. Chalkbeat reports that a letter from Superintendent Cordova to the school families says that Marisol Enriquez is no longer principal at Inspire Elementary School in Northeast Denver. The school's attorney wrote to the boy's grandmother saying that Enriquez had treated the boy in a manner different from a white student. The school board is set to vote on Monday whether to fire her from the district. It will be mostly sunny today with highs in the low to mid-90s and isolated afternoon showers and thunderstorms. Tomorrow, sunny skies but cooler with highs in the upper 70s and lower 80s and afternoon storms possible. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, as we heard in headlines and also on Democracy Now!, thousands of people gathered in Aurora on Saturday, shutting down parts of the highway, but also gathering for a peaceful violin memorial for Elijah McClain. That was met by riot police. Well, joining us now to talk more about what happened on Saturday, but also the wider case of why it has taken almost a year for the case of Elijah McClain to get this kind of attention, we have on the phone Omar Montgomery. Omar is the president of the NAACP Aurora chapter, and he joins us now by phone. Good morning, Omar. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Omar, I should also mention the last time you were on KGNU was in 2019 when you were a mayoral candidate as well for Aurora. You've been involved in what's happening there for many, many years. You were there on Saturday. Give us a sense of what was happening on Saturday.
Well, Saturday, I got there. I was there for the morning part of the demonstrations that were taking place. I was there till mid-afternoon because you also know there was a young man that was murdered in the park, Xavier Sturgis, a couple of days ago, and went to his family had their funeral on Saturday. So I had to leave and go participate in that event. But getting back to the event on Saturday while I was there, it seems to be a very peaceful event. Yes, there were people that were voicing their opinions and may have gotten under the skin of some people. But I thought it was a rally that people were able to just share how they were feeling emotionally about the death, not just the death of Elijah McClain, but you heard people in the crowd say, hey, he was my experience with law enforcement. Here's what we need to do to create change. Here's what we need to do to build community and police patience. So you had all sorts of different messages that was being spread throughout the crowd. And while I was there, I thought it was extremely peaceful.
All of this is happening at a time when the city council in Aurora are deciding, well, city officials are deciding on a new chief of police. And just last week, we heard a forum with the four final candidates, and they all addressed the issue of Elijah McLean. Some from out of town weren't as familiar with the case. But do you get a sense that the police department is really paying attention to what's happening right now, particularly when we see the response that was brought down on the protesters and around the violin vigil?
I was extremely shocked at the response that took place. I wasn't there that evening, but my phone started ringing as it was happening. People showing me live video because I couldn't get back in once I left. Everything was pretty much blocked off. And so I said, instead of parking a few blocks away, I decided to go home because I thought everything was going to end the way it started. And when people started showing me videos of law enforcement personnel with riot gear on, and people playing the violin, and it seemed to be peaceful, I couldn't understand. I wasn't there, so I'm not trying to make any judgments. But what I am saying is that the people that were there were alarmed. They were frightened. They felt intimidated. And that's something we have to address. We have to begin to look at policing as, is it them versus us, or us versus them? Or are we one community trying to keep our community safe? And if we're not working towards that goal of having one community where you're a law enforcement officer that believes you're also a part of the city of Aurora, then are you a resident of Aurora that believes and trusts in your law enforcement agency? If we're not working towards that goal, then we have to look at something different.
From what you heard in any of the forums that took place last week with the candidates who are hoping to be the next chief of police in Aurora, do you get a sense that that change might come?
You know, whenever you're interviewing for a job, you have your mask on. Just to be honest, you have your mask on, and you hope that the person that is selected truly believe in this concept that the police of Aurora, APD, our judicial districts, the whole criminal justice system is a part of the community. Because if you don't look at it from that perspective, you're going to keep having disparities in schools where kids are being suspended and expelled. You're going to keep having disparities where some communities are over-policed and some communities are under-policed. It should be a system where we're not trying to arrest people. We're not trying to intimidate people. But we're trying to have a law enforcement agency that's just trying to keep people safe without ruining their lives. Now, if there's an extreme situation, yes, use your training to deal with that extreme situation. But most situations, let's take Elijah McLean. He was just walking home. He had a ski mask on. So what? That's not a crime. And because someone called in with their biases or whatever, this young man was stopped. He was verbally attacked. He was in shock. He didn't know what was going on. We cannot have policing like that in the community no more. Something must be done different. And if one of these individuals feel that they have the leadership to change the culture of law enforcement and be the model that we can be, then I hope they select the best candidate. What I saw four candidates that I thought could do a good job, but I really want to hear from their communities, especially the outside ones, what were they like before they applied? Were they applying the same things that they're talking about now, or this is just because they're running for chief and they know that the political environment is not going to allow for traditional policing like we had in the past?
Omar Montgomery, why do you think it's taken since last August 10 months for this to get the type of attention to the case when there have been activists and groups like yourselves who have been working and calling on Adams County District Attorney Dave Young to reinvestigate this. It's now nearly July 2020, 10 months later, and Governor Polis has now called for Phil Weiser, the Attorney General, to investigate. Why has it taken this long?
Unfortunately, it took lives being sacrificed, not that they sacrificed their lives, but lives being sacrificed, such as Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. It took that vision of George Floyd having that knee on his neck until he unfortunately passed away in front of everyone that witnessed it, the people that videotaped it, and then the world had to relive it. And we also have to say that COVID-19 may have played a role in it, where people are at home looking at social media, paying more attention to the news, paying more attention to politics. And now it has resonated. Hey, what people have been talking about since post-Reconstruction, since Jim Crow, since the Rodney King incident in 1992, since the Watts riots in 1965, since Ferguson, people have been, comedians talk about it in their skits. Singers talk about it in their songs. So we've been talking about this for years, but now it has resonated in the psyche of the American people that something is wrong with our criminal justice system and it needs an overhaul. Now let's bring it back to Elijah McClain. Now people are seeing some of the similarities between the Elijah McClain case and between the George Floyd case. I have to give it up to activists like Candace Bailey, Lindsay Minter, April Young, Terrence Roberts, and the family of Elijah McClain, the attorney for Elijah McClain, who's been keeping this at the forefront since day one. And now the world has awakened to what took place in Aurora, Colorado with Elijah McClain. And hopefully, but because of this surge of people understanding what's taking place, we can see something done different in this case so that we can begin to see build that trust between our law enforcement community and our community itself. It can no longer be us versus them or nothing to get done.
Well, just as we finish up, the Aurora City Council has appointed a new task force to address police-civilian relations. You're one of the members of that board. We now have the Attorney General of the state, Phil Weiser, investigating this. What do you hope will come out of all of this?
This is what I hope will happen. First of all, I hope that we have an election that plays a part in this as well, Judicial District 17 and 18. I hope we get some people in there that understand the criminal justice system and not just prosecute people for whatever. Second, I hope we select a police chief that truly understand the concept of building relationships between the community and the law enforcement community, making sure we're one and not one against the other. And next but not least, the independent investigation that's also being done by the city of Aurora by independent group that specializes, hopefully, that specializes in investigating events like this that the community can believe in, along with the investigation from Phil Weiser. If we can look at both of those facts from both those independent investigations and begin to figure out what we can learn, and also what can still be done to hold people accountable for the death of Elijah McClain. As for the task force has one goal, and that goal is to figure out how the city of Aurora has an independent investigation entity to look at police abuse cases or if someone died at the hands of a law enforcement incident, meaning that when we have an independent monitor, or will we have something like an independent review board? And our goal is to see what is the best model for the city of Aurora moving forward so that the community can have trust that we're doing all we can to make sure that black people are not being killed, unarmed black people are not being killed by law enforcement, and also that there's fair judgment on both sides, that the officer has a fair investigation process to either clear their name or hold them accountable, and also something that the community can believe in so that we all can move forward and begin the healing process.
Omar Montgomery is the president of the Aurora NAACP. He's a former mayoral candidate in the city, and he's just been appointed to a new task force this month by Aurora City Council. He's one of 13 members of that that's working to address police-civilian relations. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us this morning, Omar Montgomery.
I want to say thank you for having me and thank you for the work you're doing to spread the word.
Thank you so much. It is 8:23. You're listening to KGNU. Chants from Saturday's rally. Say his name, Elijah McLean. It is 8:24. You're listening to KGNU. Well, Boulder's struggle with affordable housing and homelessness could get much worse in the coming months due to the coronavirus pandemic. The high level of unemployment is likely to mean eviction for tenants who can't pay their rent. At the same time, Boulder voters are poised to decide a ballot issue this November entitled No Eviction Without Representation. KGNU's Ros Brown has more.
The most recent data available is from 2016 and shows there were at least 44,000 evictions filed across the state that year. And that was well before massive unemployment due to COVID-19. Rui Irango is with the grassroots group collecting signatures for the Boulder ballot measure, No Eviction Without Representation.
For those listeners that don't know about the initiative, it will provide free legal counsel, aka a free attorney, to every single renter in the city of Boulder that experiences eviction. This attorney will be available to folks regardless of their income, age, or immigration status. So it's going to be a universal program. And we think that folks who experience eviction should have the right to an attorney much in the same way that you have the right to a public defender in criminal court, because the effects of eviction are ruinous. They can ruin someone's life. And newer is all the more important right now because we are on the precipice of a real tsunami of evictions, unfortunately, because of this COVID crisis. The lack of rental assistance on any meaningful level nationwide has meant that, you know, all these folks who, through no fault of their own, have lost their jobs, their income, still have to make rent, and many of them can't and won't be able to. And so we're going to see a pretty drastic and terrible increase in the amount of evictions here in Boulder and also throughout the nation. So the need for right to counsel programs to defend renters, tenants against eviction is all the more pressing.
Arango says in normal times, meaning non-pandemic times, a renter has a short window to respond to an eviction summons, and fewer than 2% of renters who appear in court have been able to find or afford legal aid. Mostly, they just move out of their homes rather than argue their case. Arango says at the same time, more than 88% of landlords are represented by attorneys in eviction court.
I think evictions have been worsening here in Boulder as across the nation. I will let you know that in the past 4 years, the number of summons to eviction courts in the county have risen by 27%, which is a lot. And that is even before the COVID crisis has hit. But, you know, we are a group of volunteers, working class folks, and we think that the best thing the working class can do, and we do include renters there, is to advocate for ourselves and create our own power.
Early on in the pandemic, like most governors, Jared Polis placed a moratorium on evictions. But as of mid-June, the order is more limited, with Colorado landlords required to provide tenants with 30 days' notice. It's normally just 10 days. Essentially, the revised order delays new eviction filings until mid-July, and Polis has directed the State Department of Local Affairs to work with landlords to implement rent repayment agreements. But that's not going to help everyone, and Rango says Boulder is long overdue to have more renter protections.
Cities that are way less affluent than Boulder have had right-to-counsel programs that have been active for much longer. And in this case, Boulder is absolutely behind the times. It's sort of a shame that a citizen initiative has to be the one to do this, as opposed to our elected officials implementing something like this. That being said, we are fortunate in a way that we can build on the shoulders of other tenant advocates and working class movements that have developed right to counsel programs and really improve on what has come before. So again, I do think that the No Eviction Without Representation initiative is pretty much going to set up the best right to counsel anti-eviction program in the nation here in the city of Boulder.
The group turned in 473 signatures to the Boulder City Clerk on Friday and expects to be approved for the November ballot. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
It is 8:28. Well, June is Immigrant Heritage Month, and 2020 is an important year, and immigration is going to play a major role in that. In honour of that, we're partnering with Motus Theatre to present Shoebox Stories. It's a unique story holding project. People stand in another person's shoes by reading aloud their stories. And these are the stories of undocumented immigrants. In July, we're going to be bringing them to you on Wednesday mornings starting at 9 a.m. That's in mid-July. But this morning, we're actually going to kick it off at 8:35. To give us a sense of what this project's all about, I spoke with Tanya Chavez, who is the National Outreach and Education Director for Motus Theatre, the group behind Shoebox Stories.
There's definitely so many instances of how storytelling really impacts people. And we have a secret mission, and our secret mission is really to get the audience to fall in love with our monologuists. And we know that once people fall in love with our monologuists, they will hold those stories close as they're making policy decisions, as they're voting. And I mean, as you mentioned, this is an incredibly important year. We just had so many really big SCOTUS decisions, but now we're leading up into elections. And it's so critical for people to get involved in whatever way they can. And it starts by listening to our stories. It starts by paying attention and opening their hearts, because that's really where we see the biggest impact.
Well, in addition to being an activist around immigration rights, Tanya herself has stepped into that space because she herself is an undocumented immigrant. So she holds both of those realities at once, something that's hard to do in these political times.
It looks like having to translate Know Your Rights materials into various languages and making it kid-friendly. I had to do a Know Your Rights training for an entire family, and their youngest child was around 10, maybe 9, around that age. And so having to sort of rearrange the entire contents of a Know Your Rights training for someone who's 9 years old is the most heart-wrenching thing I've ever had to do. It also sounds like me calling my dad whenever he's going too far out of like the general vicinity and being like, hey, be safe out there, because not everyone has like as progressive laws as Denver or wherever. And so it looks like me checking in on him fairly often. And it feels like a lot. It's a lot.
Tanya Chavez, National Outreach and Education Director for Motus Theatre. And we're going to hear the first installment in the Shoebox Stories podcast series. That's coming up at 8:35.